Good afternoon and welcome to Talk of the Towns. We try to go beyond the headlines to make sense of the issues facing Maine communities, to share what works, seek alternative solutions. Talk of the Towns is aired on WERU Community Radio since 1993, dedicated to the proposition that everyone benefits when we share our knowledge, our experience, our concerns, and our perspectives. We're about to practice the magic of community radio, in which those of us in our virtual studio and you who are listening create a dialogue we hope will be of benefit to our friends, our neighbors, and colleagues. We're your hosts, Ron Beard and Liz Graves, and we hope you'll stay with us for the next hour and Talk of the Towns. And a reminder that we are recording this show in advance and won't be taking any calls today. So, what are some of the keys to building a vibrant community? Singer-songwriter Dar Williams has made some suggestions based on what she has found and wrote about in her book, What I Found in a Thousand Times, 10,000 Towns. Sorry about that. So today, we're delighted to have Dar Williams in conversation with us and two community activists who have kind of shared her passion for community building. Johanna Blackman is the executive director of A Climate to Thrive based on Mount Desert Island, but with roots and tendrils going statewide in Maine. And Andy Redkin is a world-class journalist, mainly focused on climate issues in the recent past, and he's also a wonderful singer and songwriter himself. So we're glad to have all of you with us today. Perhaps we'll get started by asking each of you for a little bit of your own background, perhaps how you connect to Down East Maine. Andy, why don't we start with you? How did you kind of wash up in Down East Maine from New York?
I had come here from Rhode Island when I was a kid, where I was born and raised a couple of times with my family. And then I worked here in summer. Before I was a journalist, I worked at the Acadia, what was it called? The Acadia Institute for Oceanography. It's a summer school on the island. And I just fell in love with the place, of course. And then I've come back recently because my now wife, Lisa, has deep roots here. Her mom lives still in Winter Harbor. And we're helping her through the day and approaching age 94, and Lisa and I settled here because we both grew up in New England and we love it. I live by the Tide app.
That's great.
Of course, this is 4 or 5 years ago, and now I've become really fallen in love with the musical community and the communities around us too.
Great. Johanna Blackman, tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up here and doing this wonderful work with A Climate to Thrive.
Well, thank you for having me here today. I grew up in New Hampshire, so not too far from here, and had heard about Mount Desert Island and this area, Acadia National Park, but I'd never been here. I was traveling after undergrad and was in Hawaii and met the man who is now my husband. And he grew up here on the island after being born initially in Nova Scotia and was telling me about it and invited me to come visit him when we both got back from Hawaii, which I did. And so I got to fall in love with my husband and this island at the same time. And after graduate school, we decided to come back here and make a life here.
Mm. Dar, do you have connections to, you've certainly got musical connections many places. Tell us a little bit about how you've connected with Maine.
Well, you know, my aunt and uncle lived in just outside of Portland. And I have to say, it was probably one of the first experiences I had of feeling like I was in a place that was like no other. You could blindfold me and set me loose, you know, around their sort of the bays that they would take us to. And I would say, oh, this is that Maine place. So that was fantastic. But touring has also just been wonderful. And people in Maine have introduced me. We have some wonderful friends just outside of Belfast who introduced me to MAFCA and the Common Ground Festival and, you know, all of the things that make Maine work, you know, for all, you know, this great agrarian state, but they make it work for all.
I love the phrase that my friend Earl Breckland, who's former editor of the local paper, Liz followed in his stance. And he used to say, I wasn't born in Maine, but I got here as soon as I could. And it's a wonderful sense of how Maine is a community for all kinds of people. Dark, tell us a little bit about your journey as a musician and songwriter. First kind of gave you a clue that that's what your work in your career was going to be?
We were a musical family, which I just thought was normal because it was the 70s, you know? So we sang in the car and I was a third child, so I had to figure out the third harmony. And I thought that was normal too. I'm like, well, you know, birth order dictates. You know, there was just music everywhere. Everyone played an instrument. Everyone was expected to, but not too early. You know, it wasn't the virtuosity that was emphasized. It was, you know, you're going to have to join something. I tried to be a jock for a couple of years in high school, and luckily followed my friend into her chorus class. Then there was an audition for Godspell, and I twisted my ankle, which was fantastic. Thank goodness. And so that changed everything. And then I went to college for theater, and after college, went to Boston instead of New York, because New York just seemed to kind of be sucking people down. But Boston's a music town, and that's really what it was. So you could go to an open mic 7 days a week. They were all called like the new moon, the half moon, the crescent moon. It was amazing. It was literally music everywhere. And I couldn't, I immersed myself in that. And here I am.
And how about social justice as a focus? You've certainly been such a champion for people and causes and trying to bring about a better world. Was there some particular set of circumstances that led you in that particular direction?
I think everything in my life, all the people in my life, but this is also kind of maybe coming out of the 70s. Like the first week of college, I went to Wesleyan and somebody got up on the steps with a big flowing ponytail, this guy, and he was like, I'm painting houses on the other side of town, and that's what I'm doing with my education. And, you know, what are you going to do with your education? How are you going to make it connect with the world that we want to see, that's more just, that's more equal, and there's no peace without justice? You know, that was all there, and we were all like in love with that guy. And it's funny because now I interviewed him for What I Found in 1,000 Towns, and he is doing still incredible stuff with a nonprofit health clinic that just kind of aspires to do every single thing right, like as top notch as possible. And so he's still that guy, less hair, but that echoed, I think my parents were kind of like, well, it's great if you get an education, but what are you going to do with it? You know, and Schumacher, E.L. Schumacher in Small is Beautiful said the same, sort of like, if you're lucky enough to get an incredible education, how are you going to bridge with it? And I think that's a big ethos that I saw. It helps people have thriving communities as well. Is the ability to bridge to one another in interesting ways, more so than with the intent of justice, just for the sake of bridging itself.
Mm. And how long had you been touring before you said, I think there's something here that I'm looking at, and that led to your wonderful book, What I Found, What I Learned in 1,000 Towns. Tell us about how you came to that realization that there's something to write down.
I feel really fortunate. I was at a dinner party with some friends, and my friend was, you know, refilling everyone's wine glasses, and he loves you know, studies. He said, I just read a Harvard study in this, and they said that he said that there's one thing that really determines relationships. And I was like, politics. he said, no. And I said, hobbies? And he said, no. He said, proximity. And I had heard so much about negative proximity. You know, the ways that people used proximity made people homophobic, but no, I was, sort of claustrophobic. And also, yeah, sort of very othering in some ways because you let yourself get so peeved by stuff. And I thought, no, I'm wrong. People, you know, you know this person, you know this person. Then you all show up at, you know, they're the ones who tell you about the town meetings, and they're the ones who share parts of their gardens with you, and they're, you know, they're the people you feast with, and they give you information, and you give them, and you know, it's and I so I said, there's positive proximity, and I thought, how do towns build positive proximities? And not only that, because I don't get on a bicycle as soon as I get. Some people have a tour, you know, a bicycle on a tour bus, and they just get off at the bike on a bicycle as soon as they get off the bus. And some people draw. A lot of people just have another thing. And I thought, gosh, all I ever do is just walk around and look at how stuff is put together. And I thought, oh, but this is my moment, because I keep on saying, how did this town figure out how to get the good coffee, the cool exhibits, the fun onion festivals? Or I remember my family was all into André the Seal when we visit Maine, and that was such a uniting force, you know, just the it was so uniquely Maine. You know, how do people have all this fun, good, durable, interconnected stuff? That's positive proximity. How do they build that? And I had answers. I had a lot of answers. I had been observing for 20 years, and I called my mom and said, I feel like I'm seeing this thing that I call positive proximity. Is that a thing? And she said, honey, I think that's a thing. So I spent a year developing what I thought was that thing. Then I got a book contract and wrote the book.
Well, I'm delighted to have you in this radio show, because when I was teaching a course on community development at College of the Atlantic here in Bar Harbor, we used your book, and students really related to the many different kinds of ways that you kind of brought forth and highlighted that they recognized in their communities. And then I said, well, okay, that's what you want to focus on. You want to go find those examples and build on those. So again, thank you for the book. Can you perhaps tell a couple of stories of some of those examples? What springs to mind for you?
At first, you know, when I wrote the book, I had written half the book, and it was basically what I realized is that there are sort of categories of what allowed people to build and maintain and grow positive proximity. And it was I just went all over the place, and the editor said, I feel sick. I feel seasick. I can't. You have to find every city has to be an example of one of the things you're talking about. I often come back to Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, where I was playing at the Colonial Theater, and they said, you've got to come back for Blobfest. You've got to come back for Blobfest. And Phoenixville has a really thriving downtown with a very notorious history for a very not thriving downtown. So it was very interesting to me. I came back for Blobfest, and one of the categories in the book of how people build positive proximity is through history, through how they share their history and how they bring that fourth dimension, that extra resonance into their three-dimensional lives walking down the street. You know, you feel that history. They Blobfest is a weekend-long celebration of the fact that the Blob was filmed in Phoenixville and towns around it by a B movie making Christian film company, and but they got Steve McQueen for that one, so that's the famous one. The Colonial Theater, where I had played, is in that is in the movie. So I so they have this thing at the Colonial on Friday night. They have a variety show based on the 50s, so people have big bouffant hair and stuff, and I believe they show student films at that thing. And then at 9:30 at night, everybody stands up in their seat the way they do in the movie, when because the blob comes into the Colonial Theater in the movie, they scream and they run out the front door, and everybody's waiting for them with their cameras, and and so I, so that's a story around which they started. They had a tin hat parade, but then they decided to make it a tin hat exhibit because we all know we have to wear tin hats to keep out the alien frequencies. And then, so they have an exhibit. The restaurants get involved. You know, everybody gets involved, and it's a sci-fi weekend. So I was there for Godzilla weekend when I finally went. That's an example of something that was this thing that brought together all of these different bodies into a room. And it kept on building. You know, they just, a person said, I have this to add. And they said, yeah, sure. Just organize it yourself and bring it on in. So much came out of it, including the recognition that they're Phoenixville. So they also have a Firebird Festival where the town gets together and builds a giant firebird for 3 weeks out of wood pallets, putting people side by side with skills and without skills and of very different income backgrounds. So again, just all of that bridging happens. It coincides with a restaurant week that helps the downtown. That's the kind of thing that exemplifies bridging, you know, not just bonding with people who are the same religion, the same income status, but bridging with different people in your community. And it inevitably you're sitting there hammering side by side. You talk about the schools, you talk about the library, you talk about the next thing. That's I'll use Phoenixville as my central example, but there are many like that.
Great. I'll just remind listeners they're tuned to Talk of the Towns this afternoon. We're speaking with Dar Williams, a singer, songwriter, and author of What I Learned in a Thousand Towns. Joined also with us is Andy Revkin, a journalist, musician, and podcaster. He does the podcast Sustain What? And Johanna Blackman, executive director of A Climate to Thrive. And Dar, we were talking about some of the examples and some of the connect categories that you connect are spaces, projects, and then something you call translation. And that translation is that bridging, I think, how to have conversations that bridge between people. Say a little bit about more of those three categories, if you will, and then we'll see if there's some other examples.
Well, for spaces, there are just certain kinds of spaces, and I learned about this from a space called the Thonic Clash Cafe in Beacon, which is a very hot town,
Hey.
and but it was in it was it the Thonic Clash was the crucible, and I thought, okay, wow, there's a certain kind of cafe, the messy bulletin board, you know, the big busy bulletin board that draws you in and not only pulls you in, you say, oh goodness, you know, like there's the yoga class I'm looking for, or whatever. That also introduces you to sort of what an incredible patchwork you have around you, you know, to the good fortune of that, is a cool thing to have in a cafe. A really cool barista, Rick Price, was the cool guy who knew everybody and told people histories and stories. That's cool. Lots of different kinds of seating places are important. A toy corner, because you've got parents who are just like, they are dying to talk to other parents. And once they do, what they want to talk about are opportunities that they're creating or have found for their kids and for CSAs and stuff. I discovered, so there are interior spaces like that I discovered. And Beacon was a big example of how they use spaces to meet one another. Outdoor spaces are, I use Wilmington, Delaware, and it's Riverwalk because Wilmington, Delaware has enormous income gaps because Dow Chemical and the other one, DuPont, are there. Wilmington, Delaware has this river walk that brings everybody into the city and brings a lot of that money into the city and it's just wide open for people to discover one another. So spaces that allow people to kind of reflect and meet on their own terms, I think that's really helpful. Projects are food, culture, history, and something else. But translation, Ron, you're right. Like, that's the most interesting to me, because it's kind of something you feel a sense of open palms as opposed to clenched fists. You know, in the place where I live right now, we're really trying to figure out how to manage our visitors. And a lot of the stores, the first thing you see is a sign that says, you can't use our bathroom. A lot of towns I go to have a sign that says, come in, we're awesome. You know, and our town has a lot of positive proximity, as Andy knows. But we could go farther. You know, I think the open palms to the world are really important. And so radio stations are actually a big part of translation. And ERU in particular, I remember somebody doing dream analysis on one of their shows and using themselves, the host using herself as an example, like telling a dream. And the dream analyst was like, oh man, so like, what's your deal with your mom? And the host being like, oh wow, okay. You know, like that kind of jump in with both feet. We are the example of your community as well as the people who bring you information and inspiration. That's a really great thing that community radios can do, you know, showing that your awesome fellow people are right there broadcasting. Good signs, good sidewalks, working traffic lights. That's actually part of translation, a local paper if you've got it. And places that take it upon themselves. I don't know how your food co-op's doing these days, but co-ops are great places, and bulletin boards to get that sense of access, and very different kinds of points of access. The more, the better for people to figure out, you know, where they fit in, even extreme introverts. Those are sort of the three categories. Projects are just how you don't say the word community. You just have an onion festival and people talk to each other and they find each other. And the next thing you know, they're very proud to live where they are, not just because of the project, because the relationships that they had organizing and attending that thing.
Great. Great. Liz, why don't you take it to the next level?
All right. Yes. Level. Okay, so before I'm excited to bring in our two other esteemed guests, but before I do, I just want to be on the record as saying what a joy and honor it is to share this space with Dara this morning. Your work has been a huge part of my life. And if, you know, my 2003 self knew that I would get to interview you in 2026 or have you on the radio show that I co-host and produce, I'd just fall over. Faint. So it's very, very cool. Thank you so much. All right. So to introduce and bring in Andy, there's all sorts of cool connections. And one of them I really love is Dar talked about using education to build bridges. And it occurs to me that one of the things we're talking about, and Andy and I have both been very inspired by the work of Pete Seeger, and especially the Hudson River Sloop Clearwater that he catalyzed, is telling your neighbors not just, oh, I built a bridge that you can use, but how to be bridge builders, all of us.
Yeah.
And so Andy was a science correspondent focusing largely on climate for the New York Times for many years. And it occurs to me that both your work in journalism and the music that you're focusing on now are both ways, like these two aspects of Dar's work that we've talked about, both ways of reflecting back what you notice in a way that changes the readers' and the listeners' experience of what they might also have experienced.
Yeah.
Tell us what that's been like.
Well, that, Dar was talking about positive proximity. The thing I love most, and I mean, I remember so many and cherish so many things about Pete Seeger, but the thing that's at the top of the page of my blog is him doing this, and hand to ear. In other words, he would be leading a song, but it was never him leading the song. He always was coaching people through the lyrics, always about participation, always about sort of music as a communal experience, where there isn't a barrier between the audience and the player. And that translated in my journalism in a way. When I, as you said, I was a correspondent. I'd spent decades, my first, well, through from 1983 to 2003, whatever that is. That's a lot of time, in a one-way relationship with my readers. I would write something and maybe there would be a letter to the editor, but it was mostly me going around the world looking at stuff and then putting it out there for you to read and absorb and maybe change. And in 2003, I went to the North Pole for the New York Times, out on the sea ice, floating, cr cr the crunching, drifting sea ice at the North Pole with scientists trying to understand the Arctic Ocean. And I'd brought a camera, a camcorder and stuff, because I thought of myself as being a cool multimedia reporter even in 2003. I didn't have, but it was a young web editor at the time. So I was on my satellite phone with her and Rebecca de Moline, and she said, "Hey, let's do a reader Q&A." So this is, I don't know, a decade before there's a thing called an Ask Me Anything or Reddit or all that stuff. She said, she posted a note on the website, which was still pretty young at that time, and said, "Hey, Andy Revkins at the North Pole for the New York Times, do you have questions?" And it was so primitive that she would just tell me the question on the phone, and I would tell her the answer on the phone, and she would type it in. But that was my first, really my first experience having a conversation with readers. So it wasn't just me being the professorial, New York Times, God's eye view voice. And by 2007, at the Times, while I was still doing my regular reporting, I created a blog. And that blog quickly became a community. It was dispersed. We now global is not just, global, local. It is a reality. I met people and got to know people and became friends with people around the world through that proximity. Sort of virtual proximity can be a real thing. And that the six of my readers at one point self-organized from different parts of the US to come to New York City and meet each other. Whether they met me or not was almost incidental. And that was my triumph of my daughter's experience. It was just like the New York Times never really got it. It was kind of this like they knew I was doing it, but they never really understood it. And I understood it. And what I do now with my Sustain What webcast and blog is simply like you do on a talk radio show, with a community orientation. I ask questions. I bring people together. Sometimes they're on the opposite sides of the world, and I'm having them in a conversation. They're different disciplines. So that's my positive proximity learning curve as a journalist. And now, of course, here, living here as in the Hudson Valley, I've done what I can to get to know the actual real proximal community. And anyone in Maine knows, you think of like purple state. It's not purple. It's red and blue. It's like a Sidney Pollack painting, like poop, 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 dry, a bright blue spot right next to a red spot. The lobsterman right down the road, and that illustrates the potential for having conversations that can cross some of the barriers that are so polarizing when they're just sort of virtual. And so that's been wonderful here, and the musical community here is just fantastic.
Well, one detail on that, and then I'll turn to Johanna, which is that do you have a favorite? I know you make use of a lot of open mics. Do you have a favorite open mic story from the last couple of years from
Me?
since you've moved here? Yeah.
Well, they're all great because people here are so dispersed, especially in winter. Open mics are best in the winter because you're all hunkered down, like, semi-hibernation, and you come together once a week or once a month. And there was one in Surrey, and you travel to one in another town, and you're meeting this dispersed community of musicians who are like-minded. But so that's great. The best thing by far, though, is and those who come to Dar's town talk in Belfast on Friday, July 17th, will meet Molly Gawler, who's from a fantastic family of musicians. She and a cook in Ellsworth at the Conscious Cafe, Jesse Steiger. A year and three quarters ago, they just started hosting a Monday night potluck jamboree. Up in Maine, you call it a kitchen junket. And I learned in Newfoundland, they call them kitchen parties. So it's not an open mic is kind of limited because it's one singer singing a song, then the next one. And this is communal music, old people, young people, people with deep skills, people who are just learning, all playing together and cooking together. And boy, oh boy, it's magic. And
Yeah.
again,
Thank you.
that's
In
the best.
Scotland and Ireland, they'd call that a ceilidh. It's the same kind of flavor. I just remind listeners once again that they're tuned to Talk of the Towns. Our guests are Andy Redkin, a journalist, musician, podcaster of the podcast Sustain What. Johanna Blackman, you'll hear from in a minute. She's the executive director of A Climate to Thrive. And of course, Dar Williams, singer, songwriter, and author of What I Learned in a Thousand Towns. She'll be in Bar Harbor at the Criterion Theater on the 18th of July. And we're glad to have her with us. But Liz, go ahead, you
Yeah,
continue.
okay. I can't wait to introduce you all to Johanna. She, no coincidence, like Dar, is also a theater maker. And that's important again with this sort of alchemy of, right, how do we take in what we notice and we learn and design what we're going to offer back? I mean, I promised myself I wasn't going to get choked up. But Johanna and I have had deep and broad and wide conversations over the years, met several years back. And what I want to say about Johanna and A Climate to Thrive is that we've mentioned that Maine loves history and Mainers love our history, and we do. And A Climate to Thrive is an interesting counterpoint in that it is about the future. It has always been about, we're going to look out this number of years and think about where we want to be then. And it's such a beautiful counterpoint. So I'll just say that the first of those big conversations when I was at the newspaper with Johanna and her husband were deep in, had just emerged from a big family process of deciding whether to have children in this terrifying era 10 plus years ago. And it's that big. And that important. So yeah, tell us about your work and what rings true from what we've been talking about.
That was a beautiful intro, Liz. And so now I have a 10-year-old daughter who just turned 10 and a 10-year-old organization with the Climate to Thrive. So there we go, right? Yes was a good answer in both cases. So much of what I just heard from Dar and Andy really rings true for why I think A Climate to Thrive has resonated with the communities here on MDI, but also communities throughout Maine when it comes to climate solutions to climate change that really are participatory, are embedded in the vision and the muscle of the local community. So starting with positive proximity, I think that is all about how A Climate to Thrive got started. So people were in spaces together back in 2015, in the fall, yoga studios, the post office, the library, the grocery store, and starting to talk about our concern about climate change. And we were having this experience over and over again, my husband and I, Gary and Glennon Friedman, and a group of others. And we started to talk to each other and say, well, let's formalize this. Like, people are talking, let's get together over a potluck dinner and talk about what we can do here on Mount Desert Island to address climate change and to be a model of solutions and then to share that with others. So it's not just about doing it here, it's about sharing it and doing it together more broadly. So we were in positive proximity and we created a space and we were focused on action on projects. And we launched formally in January 2016 after a series of potluck dinners. And there was over 200 people that packed into the neighborhood house in Northeast Harbor. Again, that space of positive proximity. And we were focused on what would the next projects be. And I think that what has been so impactful over the years is leading with that attitude of what Andy was just talking about with Pete Seeger. So the hand to the ear. So leading, but not leading. Going into towns, going into different spaces where we are facilitating a process and starting with listening, and then providing tools that are needed so that the people in the space can participate in a collective creative process, because climate solutions are deeply creative. Like, that's why we need artists to be involved in addressing climate change. And we provide tools like some knowledge that's necessary, or technical assistance or funding, but also the facilitation that does that translation piece that Dar was talking about, that helps, like, we hear somebody's perspective or something they've noticed in their town or a need that they're identifying, and they might not be immediately connecting that to climate solutions, but we then help connect that not only to climate solutions but to something we just heard from somebody else that they might not have seen the connection between. And as you start to do that, then you build this network of people who are seeing resonance with each other and also with these solutions that are needed locally. So I think that by leading with that listening over the years, it's really helped really accelerate that stream of projects that we've seen here on MDI, from energy projects to efficiency projects to local food projects to town plans and actions, but also the work that we've done building a network of community-driven climate action throughout the state of Maine and helping communities from throughout the state that also want to be engaged in a similar process be able to do so, and then create that positive proximity with each other, even if it's, you know, virtually, so that we can also identify when there's an opportunity for collective action that leads to new state policy or a new state plan or funding opportunity. And I think that, you know, has really been what has caused that resonance in our work. And the final thing I'd say is that addressing climate change, both like the capacity for communities to develop and implement solutions, but also to be strong in the face of the impacts we're going to see from climate change, is all about the social fabric of a community. It's all about how connected we are with each other. And so it's all about everything we're talking about here today.
Mm. All of us kind of got started a while back. And the last 10 or so years has intensified our awareness of the importance of community building, I think. Could each of you, maybe starting with Dar, talk a little bit about what the last 10 years or the last decade has meant for the work that you're doing, and how do you see that evolving?
The book, it's called What I Found in 1,000 Towns, and it came out in 2017. It came out, Trump had just been elected, and Trump was very familiar to me, to President Trump, because Roger Ailes, who was the head of Fox News, had lived in our town, and I saw some of these kind of look over your shoulder, you never know who's after you kind of narratives coming out of him. And I would say, you know, whatever your political party, it really rankles me to see a person balkanizing as a balkanizing force, which balkanizing is a great word, which means self-segregating. You know, we go off to this corner. I'm from, you know, my ancestors are from Czechoslovakia and your ancestors are from Russia. And we kind of keep to our own social functions. And lo and behold, we have these prejudices against each other because we don't know each other, even though we live a mile apart. You know, I saw that kind of balkanizing, divisive stuff. It's great when people are divided, because then large entities can come in and sort of take over and to tell you that they're going to, you know, have a big box store and not pay attention to water regulations. You know, I could see that how people going off and scurrying into their houses was helping, you know, weaken the public dialogue. I came out in 2017 and I went on the road with it and talked about the things that I'd seen in terms of town building, which actually I realized also just started out with a desire to have good coffee. Like, places with good positive proximity often just have places for a visitor to find fantastic coffee. So, you know, I kept it really, really grassroots, really down at the level of how we find each other. But people really responded to it. And I also realized that when people already had some of that fabric in place, what actually Robert Putnam, who did Bowling Alone, calls bridging social capital. Social capital is like your bank account of social goodwill. When people had a lot of bridging social capital, which means, you know, yes, when I get sick, people from my one church come to me, but luckily I also grow roses and therefore talk to my Jewish neighbor and my atheist, you know, lesbian couple next door because we all have to deal with aphids. When people had bridging social capital in their towns, they were able to see that kind of balkanizing force come from miles away. And also the sort of the climate denialism, because the climate change is not necessarily corporate friendly, you know, like nobody. So, you know, there was an encouragement for people to just scurry off and be anxious about the community instead of bonded and bridging and finding solutions. When there was bridging social capital, you saw people talking about solutions as a natural side effect of recognizing these kind of, as you say, terrifying things. You saw them having solutions. You saw them having a sense of humor. You saw them reassuring one another. You, when they had bridging, so, you know, you saw them including one another and, you know, the people who are struggling because of what climate change has done to their heating bills or things like that, you know, or their cooling bills, where I saw what I now recognize as bridging social capital, I recognized as resilience to polarizing dialogue, to climate denialism, and even sort of an encouragement to blame whole groups of people, you know, for our problems. They resisted some of the things that we would call a fascist narrative.
Ron, do you mind if I interject before you decide where to go next? We've gotten this far into the show, and I'm very proud of myself for not yet having quoted any of Dar's lyrics back to her, but it seems like the right moment to say a 30-year-old song, The Christians and the Pagans, ends with, "Where does magic come from? I think magic's in the learning." Because now when Christians sit with pagans, only pumpkin pies are burning.
Mm, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, well, and you know, the thing that I've learned is that I have these things that I came away with, and I'm like, wow, this book could have been a pamphlet, because there's certain things. One of my guiding force thoughts is the opposite of division is not unity, it is collaboration. So where we find ourselves with, you know, and again, I shouldn't mention the president, because that name can create some polarizing conversations. I really want to emphasize it's more an attitude of where we meet with the other, and as my friend Rabbi Brent says, we meet indifference. We don't meet despite difference. We kind of enjoy what is happening in difference, is where the magic happens. And so the question is, how many opportunities do we have? How many opportunities does our community kind of force us to have with a pancake breakfast where your butt is right next to another butt, you know, that have us talking to people who are different from us, so that we A, benefit, you know, take in all of that good of learning from other people, but also learn that other is can be safe and cool and funny. And, you know, the guy who yells at the town meetings, well, he just dropped a lot of acid and that's too bad, but we love him because he knows how to fix everyone's wiring, you know, something like that. Anyway, this is to say the education, the more inadvertent the education, the better. That's what I have found. The more our two communities toss us into that kind of education about other people, the more we thrive and face things with a lot of honesty and courage creativity, as Johanna says.
we're going to run out of time in this very short hour, but I'm going to turn to Andy. Andy, you've become a board member for A Climate to Thrive, and Johanna said they're celebrating their 10-year anniversary. What attracted you to that, coming from a reporter's context to a local context, and what are you proudest of in terms of A Climate to Thrive?
The model there just excited me as soon as I learned about it, because one of the big things I've learned in my journalism on climate is a big chunk of building a better relationship with the climate system is local. And vulnerability and exposure to hazards are the dominant driver of the harms that we experience from climate events. The climate is changing, but that's still not the dominant thing that's making the losses we experience. So not only is that a way to connect across those barriers Dar was talking, because no one wants to be vulnerable to one of the fundamental natures of a community is to be resilient and not be sitting ducks for something. So having those conversations be about vulnerability reduction and about energy transition, same thing, you know, electricity prices are through the roof. You can have conversations about clean energy with someone who you will never agree on climate change with. And so A Climate to Thrive is it's not about messaging either. It's about concrete difference from yelling climate crisis. Yelling climate crisis doesn't get you anywhere. And there's a whole science to that too. So that's the key to that model, I think, is, and you know, what I've been thinking about the last 10 years is more and more about information pollution along with pollution of the actual environment. You know, we're living in a world that's changing so fast, and how we communicate with each other or miscommunicate, and propaganda is a big chunk of what I do in Sustain What is about how to understand what's happening to the information around us and how to cut through that, whether it's face-to-face or whether it's virtual. How to use the positive aspects of social media, which is not about sitting there being fed stuff the algorithms want you to do, but going in with intention. So that's where we're at.
Yeah. Johanna, you recently had a wonderful celebration at the community school on Mount Desert Island, celebrating the successes of A Climate to Thrive. One of the remarkable aspects of that was that you engineered, I think, very appropriately, many different conversations or contributions from individuals. And I remember, you know, somebody who worked in the public works department standing up and talking about what A Climate to Thrive had meant to him in his work. And that struck me as this kind of bridging notion. Everybody kind of gets together. Talk a little bit about that celebration, if you would, in the context of the last 10 years, which has not been an easy 10 years.
No, it hasn't. It's kept us on our toes. Yeah, I think, you know, what we wanted to do there was really celebrate that everything that has happened through Climate to Thrive over the past decade has been the work of many and the contributions of many, and has really been because of people coming together in all the ways that we're talking about here. And so we reached out to folks who'd been collaborators throughout the years. Really what we've done is we've tried to act as a catalyst. So we'll hear, you know, a little whisper or a shout of interest, and then be there to support the realization of the vision. And so there's lots of people who've been that seed of interest over the years. And we asked them to come and talk about the work that happened through that collaboration and what was realized. And so tried to, you know, have as many different voices as we could. And it was very moving. Our board chair and myself were standing on the stage where the concert was going to happen afterwards, and watching these people stand and share their piece and sit back down. And all these people that honestly we've grown fond of, like, it's not just the work that's happened, it's the connection that we formed working together, like that what Dar was talking about, hammering together. We really care about these people. And so it was very moving to hear everybody speak.
Well, all of you are going to be participating in a wonderful thing called Town Talk on the 18th of July at Hidden Barn Books in Bar Harbor. And then there's a concert in the evening. Talk a little bit about how all this came together. And Dar, what's the origin of this notion of a Town Talk? And you do these all across the country. Go ahead.
Andy invited me to come play for Bagadoose, just saying, like, there's something really special going on here. I know Andy was one of the inspirations for the book. He was a big bridger down here in down where we live here in New York in the Hudson Valley, and is a real promoter of communitarianism, which is its own thing. So Annie invited me, and then I said, you know, I'm what I would really love to do, based on what I hear you talking about in Maine, and what based on what I know you understand, is there's this thing that I would do a presentation about the book, you know, a song about food, a song about history, a song, you know, and talk about what I've discovered about how people kind of create this social trust and these cool resilient solution based ways of communicating. I gave this presentation in Beverly, Massachusetts, sort of to explain the book, but also how it was, you know, living in my heart. And this guy said, "Yeah, but we want to talk too." And so they created this format that has held up, that I've done a number of times now, where I did this presentation. I kept it a little on the shorter side. And then they, in real time, brought chairs up onto the stage and microphones and talked about what they were doing in the community. Beverly and also then Greenfield, Mass, chose these really cool community leaders, some in government, but mostly outside. So somebody ran a tiny house festival where they celebrated tiny houses, but also combined it with like a porch music festival. Somebody in Greenfield, Massachusetts, was talking about how in the makerspace, he was an architect, he's a professional architect, and he was inviting people to come in with ideas that they had, sometimes on napkins, of what they wanted to do to their houses, ways they wanted to grow or change their houses. They came in, Rotarians came in and talked about what the Rotary Club was doing, which I had never really known before. Anyway, in these towns, people found people they considered to be community leaders and had them talk in real time about what was going on in the town. And nine times out of 10, there were tears. It was emotional. People were so happy, kind of like Johanna talking about that anniversary where people were standing up and talking. People do want to sort of testify about what works, you know, and even in the context of discussing the challenges ahead, they're isolating the communities that have traditionally got things done in, again, creative, fun ways with food, with certain events, you know, with unexpected outcomes. So I talked to Andy and he said, actually here around Bar Harbor, the gig that you're going to do there, it's such an incredible, is it the Main Bay, Andy? Is it basically there are a lot of people who come to your area because it's a very unique ecosystem, and you've just really lucked out on having a lot of people who look at climate resilience in a very informed and creative way. So we're going to have that town talk sort of focus on that kind of climate resilient town leadership in Belfast. Anna Dean is organizing musicians who are going to talk about how, as musicians, they have organized things to build culture, to build the musical culture. To, you know, musicians are very creative about figuring out how to create the kitchen junket, the open mics, concert opportunities, and also ways to fundraise for things, you know, share the microphone. They're just great that way. They're octopi. Is it octopuses or octopi? Anyway, so the musicians are going to talk about how they have been, and Andy's going to moderate that conversation. Anyway, those are going to be my town talks.
Great. Andy, tell us a little bit about what people can expect either at the town talk at the Hidden Barn Books and perhaps the concert as well.
Yeah, the one on Friday on the 17th in Belfast. Will be musicians coming together, just as you've heard, who are have played roles in community building.
Yeah.
Molly Goller is the one I know best because of the Kitchen Junket. Matthew Hawkins, Doug Holmar, and Me Human, Matt Murphy, I think, is going to be kind of helping facilitate that conversation from the station. And he also helped me wrangle people. I've gotten to know and really appreciate Carrie Jones, who's a journalist and a novelist and a writing coach based on the island, an MDI. And she runs a Substack called Bar Harbor Story. She's all about the ear to the ear to the hand of the ear, listening to the audience and blogging. Punjarat Kaur co-founded Open Table MDI, which is this wonderful communitarian weekly free meal for hardworking people. They can come and pick up the takeout meal, and or you come for your vegetarian meal there. And they have musicians. I've played there many times. And then John Zavodny, president of the Maine Seacoast Mission, which for more than 100 years has supported Maine's, the islands with no bridges. We're talking about bridges. There's a boat that's a bridge, and they go around with healthcare, education, scholarships, food assistance, and community building on islands that otherwise would be very isolated. So the boat is called the Sunbeam. I haven't been on that boat yet, but I've got to go. So that's the basic idea. That's Saturday, starting at 1, going to 2:30 on the afternoon of the 18th, ahead of the 7 p.m. show that Dara is going to do at the Criterion.
Great. Thanks so much. And we're going to run out of time, so I'm going to ask you our final question, which is, what gives you hope as we lean into this work of rebuilding or building communities here in North America and across the globe? Start with Johanna, go to Andy, and then conclude with Dar, but be brief if you can.
What gives me hope is all the times I see how much people still really care about each other and want to be connected, and that they will find really creative ways to do that when they need to.
Great. Thanks, Andy.
I hate to be duplicative, but I'm just surrounded by hope. It's demonstrated in every little connection you see made at the Kitchen Junket and the connections I make on my Sustain What webcast. Just being connective gives
me hope. Great. Dar Williams, please.
I run a thrift sale with my friends here in town, and that gives me hope. And I think concrete, being involved in side-to-side concrete stuff is a microcosm of seeing how, you know, you think we'll get a jumpsuit and we'll be like, oh, is it pants? Is it a shirt? Is it indoor? Is it out? You know, like we'll short circuit. And then we have to discuss, like, what are we going to do with this jumpsuit from the 70s? So people just gravitate towards solutions when they have the opportunity to seek that, to be that. That's their organic place, is to seek solutions and harmony. As a musician, I would say harmony. It's what we seek.
Great. We've come to the end of a very short hour. Be sure and join us from 4 to 5 on the second Wednesday afternoon of each month for Talk of the Towns. Podcasts of our program can be found in the archive section of the WERU website. If you have comments or suggestions for new topics, please email us news@weru.org. Our theme music is a medley from Coronach on a Bonlane House Highland Music recording. Thanks so much to our guests in the studio this afternoon, Dar Williams, singer, songwriter, author of What I Learned in 1,000 Towns. Andy Revkin is a journalist, musician, and podcaster with Sustain What. And Johanna Blackman is executive director of A Climate to Thrive. Thanks to our underwriters. Thanks to Joel Mann for engineering our program, and to College of the Atlantic for production help. Stay tuned for Ralph Nader Radio from 5 to 6 and 2 hours of jazz on Groove Shop from 6 to 8. Liz Graves and I are producers and hosts for Talk of the Towns. This is Ron Beard wishing you a good afternoon.